So, brethren, our study resumes in Revelation, the 12th chapter. We are just in verse 9, and we'll be moving forward. We've had a lot of discussion on 9 because we've been discussing the four different names that appear there. But what we will do is we will just go ahead and reread the chapter. It's so easy. Sister Roseanne, could you read chapter 12, verses 1 through 8, and then Sister Carrie, could you read 9 through 17?
Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then, being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she bore a male child who was to rule the nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and to his throne. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And a war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer.
And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now has come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb, and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And when the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth held the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which kept the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ.
All right. Thank you. Very good. So in our verse 9, we've been discussing, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent. And we talked about how these are both animals, even if it's mythical, they're still an animal. And then we have the devil and Satan, called the devil and Satan, which are two names that seem to imply a characteristic, if you will. Of course, both are negative. So the great dragon, the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So just in that verse 9, just how it's worded, is this one entity. Yes. Okay. Thanks, Brother Dan. Yes, it is. It's he singular. So these are all descriptive of the same identity. Now, it's referred to in the remainder of this chapter, as when we read, we see that sometimes it's one name used, one animal used, another name used, another animal used through the remainder of this chapter, which goes to solidify that we're talking about the same enemy, but it suggests that possibly there are various aspects that this enemy takes on at certain times. And in another way, it's just reconfirming that it's the same enemy, and it's just describing the deceptive elements regarding it. So I know that sounds kind of vague on one hand, but we're not really looking to find, I don't think, definitively four different, completely different aspects of the great adversary. We're seeing, I think it's demonstrating how the adversary sometimes works through civil power. Sometimes he works through a combined civil and religious power united, and sometimes he works through other means, as we know, but not in all of them, though. He's acting in a deceptive adversarial role. So last week, we had looked in Matthew 16. We had looked about how Peter had just been commended for his faith. He was given the two keys to open the high calling, first to the Jews at Pentecost and then to the Gentiles in AD 36 with Cornelius and his family. And yet he had just received this blessing of, as it were, of these two symbolic keys by Jesus. And then when Jesus tells him he has to go up and sacrifice at Jerusalem, Peter says, "Far be it from me." And Jesus turns to him and calls him an adversary, as the word Satan. And so it's just not that Peter was trying to be an adversary to the Lord. He was trying to be protective of the Lord. And yet Jesus was demonstrating that even sometimes those with the best intentions might be an adversary to us in our covenant of sacrifice. And that's what we talked about, but it helped demonstrate that word Satan, meaning adversary, can come in different ways. We did look at Paul's writing about how Eve was deceived, and how he didn't want the second Eve, the church, to be deceived and to be careful for that, for the adversary, Satan, who ministers, can appear as ministers of righteousness, and he himself can appear as an angel of light. And we talked about those aspects, and again, this deceptive mode. And then we talked about in John, the eighth chapter, I believe, seventh or eighth chapter, about how when the Pharisees were decrying Jesus as being illegitimate, not having a father, Jesus pointed out that their father was the devil, who was a liar from the beginning, a liar and a murderer from the beginning. And he uses that term devil. So we're seeing these words used in a rather interchangeably, but there does seem to be a very distinct application when we're talking about the dragon, because we see that phrase dragon appear more often in the Revelation, and it has its different symbols. It has its different expressions. And yet here in this verse 9, I think we're just being told that whether it's civil power or religious power or the combination of the two, the literal Satan is happy, as it were, to use any one of these means in order to be that deceiver and be that adversary. So, in our verse 9, these which deceived the whole world, he was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Now, it's that great dragon is this dragon that had been mentioned in verse 7. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was any more place found for him in heaven. So this is narrowing in that this dragon is a civil power that had religious authority in the emperor of the Roman Empire. Even after it became nominally Christian, yet the religious powers in the Bishop of Rome, which became eventually the line of popes the papacy, they gained the ascendancy, and in 800 we had the Pope crowning Charlemagne. And so in the nominal religious heaven, the emperors lost their authority or input, authority, as I should say. They're cast to the earth. They're just an earthly power with society, no longer having this type of religious authority, as it were. And, it gave up that term, what's the term?
Pontifex Maximus.
Thank you. Which means the bridge builder. It was building a bridge between God and man. But Pontifex Maximus, Latin, thank you. And so that had been now resides solely with these bishops of Rome, the popes, and this is our transition period. So just stopping there, any comments so far? Okay. So picking up then in verse 10, and I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you that dwell in them. Woe to the earth and to the sea, for the devil is come down unto you having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. I think we need to consider these verses kind of as a whole. So let's open that up then to comments. Is this all continuing the thought of the counterfeit? Ruth.
Well, according to that reprint 306, this loud voice in heaven is from the Pope, who was the one left in heaven after the dragon was cast out. And he's claiming all his big claims as being the vicar of Christ. And now suddenly they think that they're going to reign, and he represents the kingdom and the power of the anointed. And he's basically exalting himself over the civil power. Over.
Okay, very good. Further comments? Bardem.
Along with that, Brother Rick, in verse 10, where it says, I'll read the whole thing because I can't. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. So as Sister Ruth brought out, this is the loud voice of the papacy making the claim that the accuser of them being the civil Rome and the persecution of the true Christians, they're taking, he's claiming that now the persecutions that took place as he continues on in verse 11, and they overcame him with the blood of the Lamb. So all the martyrs of Christ from the beginning or early days of the church up till that time, when the Pope had power now, he's claiming that now that the dragon, their civil government is cast down, that the papacy now finally has rule over the earth, and so the persecution has come to an end because Christ has gained the victory, and the papacy is the recognized head of Christ, and now the church is in power, and they will rule, and that now those who go against the church, and he's claiming to be the representative of Christ ruling now over the earth. So the pagans who are not Christians, now they're going to be persecuted. And I'm not saying it well, but it's just showing the Pope's claim to now be ruling it, you know, as Christ's representative, since the civil powers have been thrown down, and this has happened through God's power. We'll just stop there. Over.
Okay, thank you. That's good. Sister Debbie.
So can we say that from verses 10 to 12, all three of those verses, that's papacy speaking?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good. Brother Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to highlight that verse 10 as well. Now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God. So this is the millennium, the counterfeit millennium. And I think that highlights the year 800 when the church became the kingmaker, as the friends have said, and I'll attach to last week's study as well. So this is a 1,000-year reign that they were gloried in so much. And, you know, the whole narrative sounds like good guys against bad guys, but it's bad guys against bad guys. And the more deceptive bad guy, at least the dragon, even though he was an accuser, a deceiver and a liar, you know, he was obvious for what he did. The other bad guy was just downright way more deceptive, way worse. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Further comment? I'd like to emphasize it this way, along with the good comments that preceded. You and I last saw the woman fleeing into the wilderness back in verse 6. So the very point when this man-child comes forth, the woman is fleeing shortly thereafter. So he comes forth. And the 313 to 539 era, and then from 539 to our 1799, we have our 1260 years that the woman's in the wilderness. So if the woman is in the wilderness, certainly in our verses 10 through 12, she's not returned out of the wilderness and is empowered to be reigning. So this can't be the true church in power reigning in verses 10 and 11, 12, because our woman is still in the wilderness. And just in case we had any doubt, the Lord brings that to our attention again in verse 14. To the woman were given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness where she would be nourished at times and half a time. So we have a confirmation. It's like a bookend. The 1260 years are mentioned at the beginning of when she flees, and it's mentioned again toward the end of her fleeing, because that's when this floodwater goes forth in the French Revolution, at the tail end of that 1260 years. So the point is, these verses 10 to 12 can't be talking about the true church ruling, just like the friends are saying. Now, it's very interesting that when you and I studied in the seventh trumpet in Revelation 11 and verse 15, look at Revelation 11:15. The seventh angel trumpeted, there were great voices in heaven saying, the kingdom of this world are become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. He shall reign forever and ever. Now, look at chapter 12, verse 10. I'll reread it, 12:10. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now has come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. See how similar it sounds. That is Satan, Antichrist system, as he begins the counterfeit millennium, as was just said, to last for 1,000 years. From the Pope coronation of Charlemagne in 800 to Napoleon Bonaparte's imprisonment of the Pope where he dies in 1799, that long counterfeit millennium. And all the splendor that's built in the Vatican and Rome and the cathedrals and the choirs and the artwork and the statues and all the pomp and ceremony of all the robes of and all the garments that the cardinals and bishops and the others all wear. All of this is Satan's attempt to make it seem as if the papacy is indeed a vision of the heavenly, to awestruck the people, especially during the Dark Ages, before the advent of electricity. All they had was these kind of things in order to impress upon the mind the power and might and splendor of this great Antichrist system, and especially when kings would support it and do honor unto the popes during that period of time. Now, it doesn't mean it wasn't rocky at times between different kings or the princes and the popes, but and the emperor of the empire. But that's a long history of 1,000 years, but primarily and predominantly the papacy was the largest influence. Does that generate any comments? Brother David.
Just one element of that, Brother Rick. The windows in these cathedrals were colored windows, that were baked in ovens to help the illiterate people understand what the papacy wanted to promote. It was a visual type of propaganda for them that when they were inside that church, they had a means of connecting all these stories and saints and the pomp and circumstance. Just another element. That's all. Thank you.
No, that's good. It's Satan spared no expense. I just briefly on that before I call on the hands, before I came into the truth, when I was searching for the truth, I did have a course on the study, historical study of taking sick people and bringing them into the cathedral. So when the light shined through those colored window panes, that colored light was supposed to heal certain maladies. And so if it was the green, it would be for the one. If it was red, it was another. If it was blue, it was another. If it was yellow, it was another. And they thought that this would have a healing properties to it. And I just thought that was kind of another twist on how in the true kingdom, there will be healing in his rays. Remember from Malachi? In the beams, it's rays. And the light of truth will have its healing in the proper kingdom. But that was a form of a counterfeit. Very interesting. Okay. Thank you, Brother David. Sister Debbie.
I was kind of thinking, you know, after I like period pieces where, you know, it talks about the kings and, you know, documentaries on the kings. It was like the kings and the Pope were always, almost always at loggerheads with each other. But the kings couldn't do anything because the Pope controlled the people. The people were very religious and they believed in certain things. And the because of that, the kings, you know, had to be careful because their people could rise up against them if the Pope said so. Over.
Very true. Very true. Thank you. Brother Mark.
Voice. Okay. So, just to keep it straight in my head here, the woman that fled into the wilderness, that's the true church. This, what's kind of left of them. They're seems like they're pretty small and they had to go kind of hiding into the wilderness, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then there was war in heaven and Michael, and we established that this was the counterfeit Michael and his angels waging war, from 539 AD there through, and include, that's that 1260 years out to 1799. And then, we also got that time period of in verse 8 and 9, Charlemagne being crowned as emperor and the papal millennium, as it were, 800 to, again, almost 1799 or 1800. And then from there, okay, I'm kind of seeing why we're saying that 9, 10, 11, 12 is papacy, kind of just boasting, although it is temporary and false boasting. But yeah, I appreciate all the comments that kind of have been said before that, and just to get me there. And then just a real quick side note, when we were there in Spain, in Barcelona, and saw that Familia, Sagrada de Familia, that church that they're still working on, they had tons of stained glass windows, and you may or may not be surprised there were a lot of people being wheeled in wheelchairs and stuff like that, I think, seeking just what you were talking about, possibly, Brother Rick, being healed by that church, or, you know, so, you know, they're very spiritual over there in Europe. So anyways, over.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Mark. Yes, Spain is like Poland is, and Italy are still very, very Catholic, Roman Catholic, and steeped in that tradition, many. Well, thank you. Ruth.
I was commenting more just on verse 11. Okay. That papacy claimed all the saints as their own. They claimed even the early saints all the way back to Peter as being their own. And so when they put them on stained glass windows, or they would have the relics, all these different ones, the early ones were actually probably faithful Christians, but they were claiming them as their own, and they took the power from those, that admiration, and claimed it. So they not only misrepresented Christ, but they misrepresented the early martyrs. Over.
Indeed, that's a key part of this understanding. They use the true early saints and faithful martyrs, which did help the Christian church to survive under the persecution from the governments. They did then claim them as their heritage. and corrupted it. Okay, good. Thank you. Berkris.
Yeah, I was just in my mind that verse 12, if those that fled into the wilderness are included at all, it might be in verse 12 because from papacy's perspective, rejoice ye heavens, that's everyone that agrees with them and has joined forces with them, follows them, and woe to the earth and the sea, for the devil has come unto them. And so everyone that disagreed with them, well, they became subject to persecution and excommunication and heretics and all that. Over.
So that's an excellent point, Brother Chris, and that does tie in our verse 12 as well. So when we talk about the poor earth, because the devil is cast down, and which is that dragon cast down. See, we're saying how their names could be interchangeable. The dragon is a civil authority. It's cast down, which means it's being subservient to the Pope and his wishes. And when you read about the Inquisitions and you read about things such as, what's that term? When a city would come under,
interdict.
Thank you. I was going to say an I word, interdict. Well, good. Since Ruth, you had your hand up too, can you explain what an interdict, what that would mean to a city or a village?
Well, if the Catholic Church, or the Pope, I'm not sure where the command was coming from, but if they put an area under an interdict, that meant that nobody could participate in confession or mass, so that anyone who died went straight to hell. So they were terrified of this interdict because their whole eternal welfare could be jeopardized by that. And children couldn't be baptized, so if something happened to them, they weren't saved and all that type of thing.
And the bodies of dead people couldn't be buried on church grounds or holy ground. And then there was the further persecutions during the Inquisition where the dragon or the civil government would enforce the rules and someone at times declared a heretic, they would confiscate all of the family's belongings, including their home. The families would be put out on the streets. The heretic, if it was the husband, father, he could be imprisoned or killed. And yet the family was left destitute. And then, as you recall in your studies of these Inquisitions, the accuser didn't even need to be identified. And sometimes they reaped the reward of, what was forfeited. So quite an evil arrangement, but that's the dragon that enforced it. Remember that age old comment that the brethren referred to, that Napoleon, when he was told, got to be careful with the papacy and the Pope, Napoleon asked, well, in essence, how many soldiers does he have? Well, he didn't have any. The Swiss Guards is just ceremonial. So the point is that that's what Charlemagne in 800, when he came to support the Bishop of Rome through his father, Pepin, their armies were protecting the Pope. The Pope crowned him. And from essentially that time forward, then the Pope was giving directions to these kings, and the kings had the armies. And so the kings were the enforcers. Like if you had a nightclub and you had a bouncer, well, the bouncer doesn't own the nightclub. He works for the nightclub owner. The Pope is the nightclub owner. These kings were the bouncers. They were the enforcers. So that's our thought of that verse 12. Woe unto those who are under religious restraint and those who weren't. If you're part of the empire, the Pope is giving his instructions to the civil powers to enforce their decrees and demands. And okay. Ruth?
I was just going to originally say that along that line, that if you read history books today, modern history books today about that era, they say, oh, we didn't, the church never did it. It was always civil power. It was always the state that did the persecution and the torturing and the imprisonment and all that type of thing. So they use it to get out of the responsibility. But according, I mean, they were pulling the strings, but they don't admit that. They just blame civil power. So.
So true. Very good. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Over.
Just a question. When it says that the devil did go down unto you having great wrath, having known that he hath little time, is this like, I'm trying to understand, this is like papacy believing it's in the millennium, therefore their version of the devil will be bound soon, as in Revelations? Is that what it's saying here? Is that the papacy believed they were in the millennium, so the devil had little time, according to them? Over.
Okay. Comments on the question?
James.
Okay. James.
I think that this is just another example of Satan playing both sides. So he makes it appear that, you know, the papacy has won, and it's like, woe to you all who aren't Catholics, right? So, because it's really their fury, but they're like making it seem like it's coming from the devil and not from them. So they would explain, all the terrible things that were done to quote unquote heretics. They wouldn't, it's almost like they're saying it's, like this is not their fault that the, pain and suffering has come upon the heretics. It's not the Catholic Church's fault. It's their own fault because the devil was inside of them. So that's why those people felt all the pain that they were tortured with, was because the devil was inside of them. And the Catholic Church was just exercising that devil. So it's like a way of, that's how I see it at least, it's like a way of them recusing themselves from any guilt. Over.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that. Further comments? Ruth.
Well, I was noticing in my margin it says, for he hath but a short time, that time is that kairos. Isn't that the word we use for the 360, like a year? Like a time being 360 years? Or is that a different word?
That's chronos, isn't it?
Oh, chronos. Okay, never mind.
Okay.
Never mind, sorry.
All right. No, I appreciate that. Well, a couple of things. One is, I haven't looked at it today. Does anyone got the second volume handy? Ruth, you got it right next to you. Page 289. I have that in conjunction with verse 12. I'm not saying it's answering Sister Debbie's question, but I think it's relevant to what we're discussing. Second volume 289. And Ruth, if you look at that, maybe you could see if you see something. Why I had that note, I just wanted to follow up on that. Now, in my mind, while we're looking for that, in my mind, what we're seeing in these verses that we've been reading here this morning is that Satan recognizes that he has to change side to the religious side and leave behind predominantly the dragon side. Not completely. No, not completely. But he realized that the attitudes of the people is allowing him now to take on the papal religious side more, than the dragon Sibyl side. There's a changing, but it's still Satan. See, it's still the devil. And I think part of this is just, the literal devil remembers that God gave this decree to Adam and Eve when they left the garden, that the seed of the woman would come in conflict with the seed of the serpent. And that the serpent's head would be bruised, even though the seed of the woman's heel would be bruised. So the death blow. So Satan, the literal devil, literal Satan, has known this from when Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden. So he recognizes that he has this sense of a limited time. And in all that he's doing, with all that the literal Satan is doing between the counterfeit religious powers and the civil powers, in the end, his goal is to get at this woman, to get at the seed of promise through it all. So I think what we see is glimpses along the way, because in this chapter, that's what we're seeing. It's the history of the gospel age. And right down to the last verse here, we recognize that the literal Satan, the literal devil, is still after and trying to thwart the seed of promise from being completed. That's how he knows he has a short time. So he knows the clock is ticking throughout the entire age, and particularly the gospel age. He was waiting to see, I hope this is not too much of a sidetrack, I hope you can still follow what I'm saying. Satan has been waiting for the revealment of this seed that he might destroy it. He persecuted natural Israel. But that wasn't the true seed. When Jesus was born, he started to recognize when the three wise men came that there was a true seed. The Christ seed had been born. And he went out, used Herod to try to kill and slaughter all the two-year-olds and under in that area of Bethlehem to try to eliminate it. And that began the time clock ticking more fervently for Satan. And so throughout this chapter, whenever we're reading, whether it's the dragon or the serpent, Satan or the devil, it's all describing to us the means by which the adversary is working through flesh and blood in order to get to stopping that true seed from being complete. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with wicked spirits in exalted places. That they know enough of the plan to know that this is what they're trying to stop. So, okay. So I think in my mind, I just have looked at it, right or wrong. I've looked at this devil knowing his short time as just a little another reminder to us of what the real action is in Satan, literal Satan's mind. He knows the clock is ticking. Okay. Ruth, did you see anything on that 289 or not so much?
The only thing I could see that had anything to do with it was this one sentence. The power of Rome was rapidly failing, and its strength and unity were divided among six claimants to the imperial honors when Constantine became emperor. And that, in part at least, he adopted Christianity to strengthen and unify his empire. So that's the only thing I could see.
Okay. Not particularly relevant. Thank you. Anything else then on Sister Debbie's question? All right, Sister Debbie, we'll have to leave it there. Food for thought, I guess. Okay. Did anyone have, I want to highlight that in that chapter 12, verse 11, in the King James, at the end of the verse, it says they love their lives not unto the death. That word "the" is spurious. It's just they love not their lives unto death is all. Not the death. That's okay. We didn't want. So we think we've pretty well covered this. Was there anything more anyone wanted to bring out on verses 10 through 12? Ruth.
The other thing it brings out on that page 289 that I thought might relate is that when it came to persecution and the reign of terror, that the pagan red dragon was a lot more liberal toward religious freedom than the papacy, so that when the papacy took over, like I was thinking, woe to the earth and the sea. The earth would be the settled society of the Roman Empire. But that had more liberty before, but now that the devil has come down to them under the control of the papacy, everybody was under terror. They had a lot more, reign of terror than the pagan government did. So that's on that page 289 as well.
All right, very good. And so in Gibbon's famous work, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, he emphasizes the point that papal Roman Empire was far bloodier and more vicious than the pagan Roman Empire. And as the papal Roman Empire is responsible for far more deaths than the pagan Roman Empire, which is kind of, one wouldn't have thought that, but that emphasizes the point that Ruth is bringing out. Okay. So the Dark Ages were the worst of times and they lasted longer as far as the persecution on true Christians. So in our verse 13, and when the dragon saw that he was cast under the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And so here again, this is just a follow-through. What a peculiar twist. The civil power now being reduced to doing the Pope's bidding. And the popes were instructing and commanding and directing the civil power, the dragon, to persecute the heretics. And the woman was considered to be the heretics. Those who were in the wilderness condition. Those who weren't in the so-called city of Babylon, nominal Babylon. So, that's where that finds us. Anything else on verse 13? Brother Dan.
Brother Rick, I was thinking just to emphasize the point of the power that the papacy had now over the civil powers was the practice of kissing the Pope's big toe, that the civil rulers were brought so low as to, they did that because of the power the papacy had over them, because the papacy ruled the people. And so if the people were turned against these civil powers, just as we were talking about, they would lose their power. They could even lose their life because the people were so afraid of what might happen if that interdict, I don't know if I said the word right, was, put upon, the area they were living in, because they believed that, all of those things that they were told by these dark sayings and superstition of the papacy, that they would go to hell or their children would be in limbo for eternity or whatever the false ideas were. They were in fear of the papacy and what they taught over.
Indeed. Okay, very good. Very good. I had a note, and this is far too long. We're not going to even read it all there, but if you are making any notes, in the second volume, on pages 332 through 356, 332 to 356, Brother Russell there notes a lot of the historical record regarding the papal persecution through the civil powers of our brethren, this woman. Okay, so it's quite a long span. You'll remember it. It's, you know, almost 20 pages, but it's approximately 20 pages, I should say. It's just, that's how much record there is available of what took place. Okay. Anything else on verse 13? So our verse 14, and to the woman were given two wings of a great eagle that she might fly into the wilderness into her place where she is nourished for a time, times and half a time from the face of the serpent. So just here, who would like to, you know, once again, we've been talking a lot about it, but it would be nice if someone could put this into their own words, the symbols of this verse. Brother Mark.
All right. Well, we've got. The two wings. Is that we're on 13? 14 now.
14, yeah.
The two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman. So more of an understanding of the Old and New Testaments. So that she could fly into the wilderness, into her place. And that's how they were nourished with what very little they knew. What was it? They had memorized things, to try and, you know, keep the truth going while they were being persecuted, I guess, from the, from papacy now that they had been risen to power and for time and a half times over.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Sister Debbie.
I'm sorry, I had a question back in verse 13, if okay. That's okay. It says the dragon saw that he was cast forth. That, I'm assuming, is a civil power.
Yeah.
So the civil power chased the woman, not the male child.
Right.
Chased the woman. And I'm trying to figure out, generally, historically, why he chased the woman. Is it because papacy was telling him to?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, the man child is now the man of, he's grown to be the man of sin and he's in control. The line of popes are in control.
So he's a dragon now.
So the line of popes are religious and they are giving instructions to the civil powers under their control to go out and persecute the heretics.
Okay.
All right. Good. Ruth.
I was thinking it's the same tactic as when he tried to kill all the babes in Bethlehem because he doesn't know who the woman is. So he's just trying to kill everybody that doesn't agree with papacy because he knows that somewhere in there is going to be the true church. So he just starts killing willy-nilly, kind of like he didn't know who Jesus was. So he killed all the babies. So it's the same MO. He didn't have any new tricks. Over.
So true. So true. Yeah. Sad. Sad history, but true. Thank you. Brother Godwin.
Thank you, Brother Rick. I've got a clarifying question. So when talking about in verse 14 about two wings of a great eagle, we understand that eagle generally symbolizes wisdom. So would it be right to understand that the true church was given the Old and New Testament and that gave them the wisdom to flee during the Dark Ages?
Yes. It's kind of along the lines of Brother Mark's comment. They were getting the wisdom from the Old and New Testament to understand the erroneous practice and doctrines of the papacy, which then led them to be outside of that nominal church or city Babylon and be in the wilderness condition on their own, as it were, and not part of any of those denominations. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
Another question. This is the dragon's chasing the woman, but the woman's fleeing from the serpent. Can you clarify that, please? Thank you.
It goes all the way back to at the outset of the study, and I know when I talk a lot, I can be tuned out pretty easily. I do get that. So I repeat, that is that we've learned and we're learning that we have the two animals and we, even though mythical in a sense, and we have these two descriptive names, adversary and accuser, deceiver. And we're seeing in this chapter how they're used in various aspects, but all going back in essence to Satan's attack on trying to annihilate the true seed. Sometimes it's through the religious perspective and sometimes the civil perspective is demonstrated. Sometimes there's the accuser aspect. Sometimes there's a deceptive aspect. It's always the adversary. So I'll give a little example. In verse 15, we note, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman. It's the serpent. Verse 16, the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the water which the dragon, not serpent, dragon cast out of his mouth. So, who cast out the water, the dragon or the serpent? Well, it's just demonstrating that it's Satan, literal Satan, was using this flood, which we'll talk about. It was a certain truth of the rights of man, you know all this, which led to the French Revolution. And those writings were of an earthly nature, about the rights of men. And yet the serpent was using that in order to try to create a persecution of the true church. We'll talk more on, but I just wanted to emphasize this point that sometimes it's the dragon and sometimes it's the serpent that's referred to, but it's the same entity. It's showing us that Satan just works in different ways to try to take hold of the woman. Brother, Sister Debbie?
Well, I just want to say I didn't tune you out, number one. The thing is I'm trying to pinpoint, I know it's all the devil in different aspects, but I'm trying to figure out which aspect. I know the dragon is the civil. The serpent is a deceiver, so I'm assuming that's the religious. And Satan is Satan himself. Those are the three aspects. And I'm trying to sort out how it all worked together. That's all. I know what you said. I'm trying to work it out in my head how all of this worked together, because you're saying the serpent cast out the water. And I'm trying to figure out how did the serpent, the religious aspect, cast out the water when it was the freedom of man and all of that. So you see the confusion. Well, it's not necessarily confusion, but I'm just trying to understand. That's all. Over.
Yep, it's a challenge. Ruth.
Well, I don't think there's any religious aspect in the serpent and the dragon and Satan and the devil. The religious here is shown in Michael in heaven. And the serpent is the adversary, like brainstorming the tactics of what the civil power is going to do. But I don't see that there's any religious in the serpent. Am I wrong?
That's a good question. Sister Carrie.
Rather than the devil standing as a symbol for the church or the civil, it's probably more accurate to say that it's influenced in the church and in the civil powers.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. The Hughes?
Yeah, I was thinking just like the dragon being civil power would use tactics like compelling people by law, or they're obliged to follow when you know that at this point the papacy is controlling the civil power, but it's through civil means, so these are laws, so they would be compelled, whereas the serpent would be tricking. So it's deceptive, just like what Sister Carrie was saying, not necessarily representing a religious movement or authority, but it certainly could manifest its way through there, because we know that the papacy was tricked and deceived. But that just serpent in general is a way of tricking members of the true church. So that way, when it says it was the woman would be out of the serpent's reach. So, and that they would be in a desert, so that shows that separation, but also the lack of water, so not having a whole lot of truth. They didn't have full truth. That at this point, the serpent wouldn't be able to trick by using aspects of truth, because that's how the serpent is that wily foe. So not like in your face, and not super, like where the civil authority would be really obvious, like here's a law, you have to follow it or else you'll be imprisoned. The serpent is using those tricky moves with parts of truth. And so that's how I see it. Over.
Okay. Very good. Appreciate that. Thank you. Parkris.
As brought out, verse 9, we get some definitions here, that the serpent is a deceiver, it's a murderer. We looked at those verses in Genesis. Down in 10, we see that the devil is the accuser and Satan is an opponent. And this is all associated with the great dragon. And this is from this papacy telling us all this. Oh man, they're just terrible. They're deceivers, liars, accusers, and look what they're doing to our heaven and all those that are associated with us. But we've also made the connection that as the friends have already commented, they're still pointing, revising history, that it wasn't the papal power, it was the great dragon, the silver powers that did all these evil things. But we're going to see quite plainly that the scriptures identify who's riding this great dragon and pulling the reins, which has already been brought out, and we already know that, but it's not really highlighting it here in such direct language, that she is the one responsible because she's controlling the head. So we'll make all those big connections later. So from papacy's perspective, she's got the fall guy, the scapegoat for all the atrocities. keeping herself clean, allegedly. Over.
All right, very good. I appreciate all that. All good comments. In our 13th chapter, which we're not there yet, I understand, but on the 13th chapter, we are introduced to the beast. And when we get to the beast, that's going to be our identifier for the papacy throughout the remainder of the book of Revelation. But we haven't been introduced to that yet. That's the next chapter, and it's a result of it. So I like Ruth's and your all's comments, a simple approach. The dragon is civil power. The serpent is the deceptive perspective of Satan using the civil power, and the devil is the deceiver. Satan is the adversary, and they're all descriptive of Satan working through the civil power to persecute the true church. And the civil power is during the 1260 years, the civil power is largely under the control of the papacy to do its bidding in persecuting the true church. All right, further comments? No, and Sister Debbie, I wasn't saying you tune me out. My own wife can tune me out, so don't, when I talk too much. So don't, I wasn't singling you out, believe me. It's a general statement. If I talk too long, it's easy to tune me out. I get it. All right. So on our verse 14, 12, 14, we see that she had a place prepared for her. What does that, and I know this is, probably sounds pretty vague, but knowing this 1260-year period is represented symbolically elsewhere, but this word a place is a condition. What's the condition that was prepared for the pure element of the church? Burdett.
The condition of separation. They were separated from nominal Christianity. They were separated in a place where they could be fed and nourished by the Lord, those two wings of the eagle. So it was a place that they could survive, they could be cared for, they could be developed as new creatures. God's protection has always been over the spirit begotten class. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Sister Cheryl.
Well, it made me think of the scripture I have right here on my wall. It says, "He will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall find refuge." So it's God, it's in his protective care. And I was just thinking through the conversation how great it is to see the symbols, you know, in the table of showbread, in the manna, in Jesus, the bread of life, in our memorial symbols. So how we're nourished and how it does come through his word, the Old and New Testament. Over.
Indeed. Very good. So true. We have all that we need. And even during the sparse years when we were reading earlier in the Revelation about the history of the gospel age, yet there was always those whom the Lord would continue. Hurt not the oil and the wine. There would be the spirit begettal and the spiritual enlightenment and the joy of the true doctrine would nourish this church. Ruth.
I was thinking that it's a reference to the condition of Elijah being at the brook, that he was separate, protected from Jezebel and fed by the ravens, which would be a source that God provided for him when there was the great famine. Over.
All right. Very good. So there was the trickle of water in a sense during the drought, which caused a famine where he would have water, and then the ravens would come to soften or wash the meat at the brook, and he could steal the food from them, so he'd have food and water provided. Very good. Avi Hughes.
Thank you. I was thinking, I wondered if this might apply, thinking of the beginning of Revelation where we see Jesus tending the lampstands and thinking that it's this place where Jesus tends to the church in each time frame, particularly that intimate relationship that those true body members have with their Lord over.
Okay. It's a promise. That's true. Thank you, Brother Chris.
Well, similar to that comment, we just remember through history, the Lord's people, they would, it was how they held to the truth that they had. They didn't have very many. Eternal torment and hellfire was not generally known. Everyone had was pretty much deceived by that. But if they understood something of baptism, and they would cling to it because that was the seal that was or the announcement or truth that they had. If they were faithful to that truth, the Lord counted that as you know, His people. And so on and so forth, that as you get farther down the stream of the gospel age, they had more and more accumulated truth to help strengthen them and sustain them and separate them. But early on, it was more of their character and their heart condition that the Lord would bless, because they were trying to be faithful. They were looking at this development of papacy. And they're probably seeing things that didn't quite measure up. And so even though they had like no place else to go, they never really joined, fully with their mind and hearts. They stood back as much as they could. And then when they could make a stand, they did. So for whatever that's worth, over.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. Thank you. Brother Norm.
I'm wondering if we would consider the reformers as supporters in helping the woman during the wilderness time. I know they weren't too many of them early on. When did the reformers start showing up? 1300s, 1400s? But I would have to think they would be quite comforting by their challenging of all these doctrines and this papal authority, that the common person would say, wow, we do have someone speaking for us and helping us to oppose all this, you know, satanic, whatever you want to call it, regime, government. So just a thought, the reformers and helping the church in the wilderness, over.
Well, that's certainly true. I think when we've read in the study of the seven churches, we had Arius in 318 along the way, but we had 313, sorry. But then we had Waldo in 1156. So that would have been part of the height of the Dark Ages and Inquisition. So we had a Peter Waldo, then we had John Wycliffe, then we had Luther and all the associates with them. So all along the way, the Lord provided some lights to encourage the true church, even though the true church was always in the minority. All right, good. Brother Mark.
Yeah, so I think you kind of answered it with that statement, too. My question is, so right from the beginning, like 539, and in there, would we say that the true church, the woman had fled into the wilderness to some extent, and then more and more they had to hide as their papacy got stronger? Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, because, and when we remember back on our studies of the seven churches, the seven seals, and the seven trumpets, when we were looking at those periods of time during the Dark Ages and so on, we were reading about the Waldensians, the Huguenots, the Lollards, and other faithful who wouldn't accept the mass and such. And so they were persecuted. They wouldn't accept the Pope. And that's who we're talking about, this woman class, the pure element of the church in the wilderness. Indeed. Okay. Well, brother, our time is winding down here for today. And make a note for next week. We'll read together in part, if not all, third volume, page 64 to 68. We'll read together in the third volume, page 64 to 68. Some are part of that. I'll have to look again and refresh my memory on what to read. But that'll help us understand verses, 14, 15, 16, a little bit better. And we'll get into that.